Well, friends, if you have your Bibles and you're turning to the Gospel of Mark, we're going to be picking back up in chapter 7. We're going to be beginning today, and particularly in verse 24. We're actually going to read through the end of chapter 7, and we're going to read the first 9 verses of chapter 8. So if you're using one of the blue Bibles around you, you're going to find this passage on page 843. So if you're using the blue Bible, you'll find it on 843. And just a reminder, if you don't have a Bible at home that you can read easily, that is our gift to you as well. So we say this, there's no greater gift that we can give to you, no book that's more valuable than the words of God. So if you don't have a copy of the scriptures that you can read easily at home, please feel free to take one of the blue Bibles with you. So today, we pick up our journey through the Gospel of Mark, beginning in verse 24 of chapter 7. So let's turn our eyes and our hearts to the scriptures. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now, the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. And she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Yes, Lord. Yet, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears and spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be opened." And his ears were opened and his tongue was released and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, "I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and they have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from far away." And his disciples answered him, "How can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place?" And he asked them, "How many loaves do you have?" They said, "7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. They took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away." So again, as we examine Mark's account of Jesus' life, if you've been with us, you are familiar with the fact that he is moving his narrative along at great speed and at great pace. Here in the span of 23 short verses, Mark gives us 3 incredible events within Jesus' ministry. As an author, Mark leaves us hanging regarding many details. So maybe you read the text for today's service prior to the service or even just now and thought, I could use a little bit more information, Mark. But friends, that's why we need to remind ourselves of the purpose of Mark's gospel. He is writing an apologetic for the Christian worldview. And by apologetic, I mean a defense of what it means to be a Christian. He's writing an argument in this gospel for believing that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Mark is less concerned with us having all of the nuanced information for every account, but rather that we encounter Jesus in his narrative And that you and I, as we read, are forced to ask this question. Who is this man? Who is this man? So again, as we behold Jesus working miracles in this text, we should be amazed by the glorious power. It is kind of striking that sometimes we can become so immune to what we read in the Gospels that it's just not fantastic anymore. Well, friends, you should be amazed by what takes place. The Son of God commands demons to flee from people who aren't physically near him. The Son of God commands the physical body of a man to change and then begin to function properly. And it does. The Son of God creates food for thousands of hungry people who have none, meeting their most desperate and immediate need. Even within what I've just said and what we have just read, we can see some thematic threads coming from these words. Did you notice that in each case, Mark highlights that those who encounter Jesus in this text encounter him while in need? They are in need. They need something that only Jesus can do. For some of them, they're at the end of their rope. Think about it. The woman's daughter is possessed. The man cannot hear and therefore cannot speak properly. This crowd has followed Jesus for days and now has no food or the ability to even feed themselves. So in each case, Jesus addresses the needs of these people and he responds to them. But he does so in a specific way. So he responds to them in such a way that his response declares who he is and what he has come to do. That's the point of what Jesus is doing here. But maybe what is more striking for us, and perhaps something that we didn't even pick up on as we were reading this text, we see Jesus encountering and interacting with people who are not Jewish. Now that may not be a surprise or may not be something that shocks you, but trust me, friends, in Jesus' day, this was quite a shocking thing to do. There's a location and audience that makes the three accounts here of massive significance for Mark's account of Jesus' ministry. So we're going to look at these three vignettes. We're going to consider what Mark tells us through them, and then we're going to finish by the greater message that these events communicate. And I want to let you in on a secret. I'm playing a game of chicken with my iPad right now. So we've got 14% battery because I forgot to charge it. So we may get out early, and we may make it to just like one vignette. So I'm just letting you know we're having some electronic chicken going on right here. So I'm confident that it's going to last. But let's look at these vignettes together. Consider the first one. Jesus and the Gentile woman. So verses 24 through 30 of chapter 7. And I think, like, if you were listening to the text as we were going through there, you might have been struck more by what Jesus said than what he did. And you would rightly understand that. For sure, the fact that Jesus casts a demon out of a person is an amazing moment. But there's a bit of conversation that takes place between Jesus and this woman that begs our attention. But before we can even get there, we kind of need to get a sense of the scene. So after the encounter we considered a couple weeks ago between Jesus and the scribes and the leaders in Jerusalem, Mark informs us, beginning in verse 24, that Jesus has left for a different region. Specifically, he tells us the region of Tyre and Sidon. Now, Tyre and Sidon were Gentile territories, which means the ethnic population that Jesus is going to would not be dominantly Jewish. So the makeup of these territories would be dominantly Gentile. Now, just to kind of be really clear here, when the Bible uses the word Gentile, it's using it as sort of a catch-all term for anybody who isn't Jewish. So a Gentile is someone who is outside of the nation of Israel. You had the nation of Israel, the Jewish people, and then everybody else. The everybody else in the New Testament is commonly referred to as Gentile. So perhaps this geographic detail maybe doesn't strike you as terribly important to you in Northern Virginia. But again, it's a key element for understanding what Mark is getting ready to reveal about Jesus' actions. But how? Why is that significant? Well, again, if you think back a couple weeks ago to the discussion between Jesus and the religious leaders, where he talks to them about what defilement was, you may remember how Jesus declared to the religious phonies And to all who heard him, that true defilement was not outside of them, but came from within their hearts. We considered, friends, that it is not your circumstances that defile you or your environment. It's actually our wicked hearts that bring about our defilement. It was statements like this that we saw last week that were the flashpoints between Jesus and the hyper-religious of his day. Now, in what could be seen as inviting more scandal, Jesus leaves the safe confines of Jewish territory for Gentile regions. Jesus is crossing into hostile cultural territory. So what will meet him there? Well, Mark tells us the same type of thing that met Jesus everywhere he went. People who were in need, broken people, people at the end of their rope, people who were desperate. Wherever Jesus went, he met the same type of humanity. So it's no overstatement to say that if you miss the significance of where Jesus is, you're going to miss the significance of what Jesus is doing. And you stand a chance of missing what this passage means for you here today. So Mark tells us that while in this region, Jesus is trying to slip in incognito, unnoticed. Did you notice that in the beginning of the text? And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. So Jesus enters a home and he's quickly greeted by someone. He's trying to fly under the radar, but if you've been reading the gospel long, you kind of know at this point that's impossible. There's nowhere Jesus goes where he's anonymous anymore. But he's quickly greeted by a woman begging him for help. But not just any woman. Mark actually goes through great detail to describe this woman that comes to him. He gets really specific about her ethnicity. Now, why would he do that? Well, friends, there's a list of cultural taboos that are taking place here. There's a couple things that we need to kind of just remind ourselves about the culture in which Jesus lived, taught, and ministered. One, it's a woman. This type of forward behavior from a woman in this society would have been frowned upon by most Jewish males. In many cases, Jewish men would not permit such directness from a woman. Think about the disciples in John chapter 4. Do you remember Jesus says, "I must go through Samaria"? And while he's there, he encounters a woman at the well, preaches the gospel to her, tells her of life that she can have in him, that he is the Messiah. And his disciples come and say, "What are you doing talking to a woman?" Because Jesus blew up cultural taboos all the time. But Mark tells us this is not a Samaritan woman, but of the same ilk. It's a Gentile woman. So it's a woman who comes. Second, it's a Gentile woman. Not only does this woman break the male-female line in the dynamic of Jesus' day, but she is a Gentile woman. Jewish males scorned such people. The racial tension was real here. The hatred between Jew and Gentile was alive, well, and it was heated. So now the woman is not only a woman, but she is a Gentile woman. But then Mark also adds another detail. She's a Syrophoenician woman. He breaks it down to the point of her birth nationality, noting specifically that she was, quote unquote, a Syrophoenician by birth. Well, friends, that right there, the significance is huge. And it's summed up well by an author named James Edwards. And so I've got the quote here because I'm going to kind of make some history lessons. So this is helpful for understanding this. James Edwards writes this: Tyre, modern Lebanon, which lay directly west and north of Galilee, was a Gentile region with a long history of antagonism to Israel. The region of Tyre, formerly Phoenicia, had been the home of Jezebel, who in Elijah's day had nearly subverted the northern kingdom with her pagan prophets and practices. During the Maccabean revolt in the 2nd century BC, Tyre, along with Ptolemais and Sidon, fought on the side of the Seleucids against the Jews. The prophets decried the wealth and terror of Tyre. Josephus concluded opprobriously that the inhabitants of Tyre were notoriously our bitterest enemies. Josephus being a Jewish historian. So think about that. This woman is not only a woman or a Gentile, but she's also a hated enemy of the Jewish people. One with a lot of bad blood throughout history. So it's by no means a stretch to say that the deck was stacked against this woman culturally. Friends, not only was she a woman and a Gentile, she was an enemy of the nation of Israel by birth. Suffice to say, the expectation of the religious leaders. So think about if we just had to compare the audiences. So last time we were together, we considered the religious leaders. How would they be scandalized by this moment? How would they treat a woman like this? Suffice to say, the expectation of the religious leaders would be that you would not associate, you would not even dignify a response to someone like this. But Jesus, the Son of God, our Messiah, is not beholden to the traditions of men, but he is beholden to the mission given to him by the Father. So it's as if Mark, in just these cursory comments, is lighting up a neon sign saying, pay attention. Jesus is doing something here with the Gentiles. He wants us to perk up our ears and say, what is going on here? Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, but this Jewish Messiah is now engaging with non-Jewish people. What do we do with that? You see, Mark wants you and I to know that what Jesus is getting ready to do will have massive implications for the kingdom of God and for the people of God. Because friends, to this point, the kingdom of God and the nation of Israel were synonymous in almost everyone's thinking. So what happens? Well, we see the woman falls at Jesus' feet and begs him for help. And if you're honest, when you read that, when you read what Jesus says to her, your first reading, what he says appears caustic, unfeeling, maybe even racist. So let's look at the dialogue between what Jesus and this woman, what they say. So verse 27, and he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Just let that statement ring out in your ears. The Son of God, speaking to a woman, says, I know you're in need, but it's not good to take food from my kid and feed it to dogs. The implication seems to say that Jesus is comparing this woman to a dog or calling her something humiliating. And the woman's response is even striking too. I mean, pick it up in verse 28. It says, she answered him, yes, Lord. Yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. So the woman somewhat agrees with the statement that Jesus says, but then also kind of doubles down and says, okay, yes, but don't dogs also get table scraps? As if she's okay with what he's just said. Verse 29, and he said to her, for this statement you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter. So let's unpack this. Because if we don't deal with this, this statement can cause us to stumble in our consideration of Jesus as the perfectly righteous Son of God and Messiah. So there's a couple things that I think will help guide you and help us understand why Jesus says what he says. First, remember this, friends. Jesus never says anything haphazardly. Think about how many careless things you say. Whether it's to those you love, to those you hate, to your children, your friends, maybe the things that echo around in the chambers of your mind, but you'd be ashamed of if we all knew what you thought. You utter a lot of words haphazardly. The Son of God never did. So if he says something like this that seems so hard, he's doing it not without purpose, but he's saying something filled with purpose. There's a reason that he is actually speaking this way. So it's far from an unfeeling insult, though it is hard. What he says is hard. There's no getting around it. We don't want to whitewash over what Jesus says. But what he says is meant to draw something out for her and for those who are witnessing the encounter. So the reality is what Jesus does, Jesus actually speaks in accordance with cultural norms when he says what he says. We would not condone any type of speech like that. We wouldn't think like that. And again, I'm not saying that Jesus said anything wrong, but he goes into the cultural norms, operates in them to break the cultural categories down. Reality doesn't have to say anything to this woman. Doesn't have to respond to anything. But he does. And what he says to her is meant to draw out a response from her. So think of a second thing as we think about what Jesus says. This comparison of Jews and Gentiles remind us of the stereotypes that existed between these two peoples. Because friends, let me assure you, the same situation in reversed roles would have been just as hostile. So what I'm saying is if Jesus were not Jewish, if he was a Gentile and he were to say these same things, were to encounter a Jewish person, his response would not be any culturally less hostile. It would still be an environment charged with electricity. So Jesus says this because what is going to come out of it is of significant importance. So he says to the woman, "Let the children be fed first." Speaking of the children of God, speaking of the nation of Israel, let them receive the blessing first, for it is not right to take what is theirs and throw it to the dogs. Again, comparing the Gentile nation to animals as opposed to children. And there's lots that's happening in the language here, but it just shows that there's a cultural divide. The woman would expect nothing different from Jesus, actually, in the way that he responds to her. So she, in this quid pro quo type argument, or this chess match, the woman doubles down. It says, "Yes, Lord, you're right. The food shouldn't be taken from the children, but in the household, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." So she goes into what Jesus says and says, "Yes, I understand what you're saying, but there's also hope for the animals." And so Jesus says something, in a sense, to sift her heart. Because think about it, friends. How many times have we gone through encounters in the gospel where people come saying wonderful, flattering things to Jesus, and we want to worship you, we want to follow you, we want to do what you would have us to say, and yet, at the first sign of trouble or difficulty, they flee. Think about the way Jesus referred to Peter. Considered by many the greatest of the disciples, he did not balk from calling Peter Satan. When Peter sought to stand in the way of Jesus being arrested and tried and crucified, Jesus turns to Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan." Again, not a haphazard phrase, but a clear statement to remind the hearer of who they're speaking to. So Jesus is sifting out whether this woman is coming in genuine faith or coming in genuine belief, or she's coming in a self-seeking manner. She responds with a faith-filled declaration. "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs receive the crumbs." And think about what Jesus responds. Look again, it says, and he said to her, "For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." You see, friends, it's not that the woman had a magic formula, but that her statement was one filled with faith. "I believe you are who you say you are, and you can command demons to flee. The crumbs here are the needs I have that I'm desiring to get from your table." And Jesus, in grace and in mercy, commends her faith. "For this statement, you can go. The demon has left your daughter." You see, friends, in Jesus' hard words, they're always filled with merciful grace. And friends, Jesus says hard things to people. But a lot of times, unless you and I hear the hard truth, we can't understand our desperate need of the glorious news of Jesus Christ. So in the case with this woman who came and she leaves getting what she had desired through coming in faith. Well, that's the first moment here. But then you have this second one. Jesus and a deaf man. So this second event is slightly less scandalous, but no less important. It tells of Jesus' encounter with a man, having been brought to Jesus by others who cannot hear and cannot speak correctly. Now just think of this in light of what we just read. Think of the event we just considered, and think of what we're talking about. Perhaps the woman had heard about Jesus. This man could hear nothing. The woman could ask Jesus for help. And in all likelihood, this man could not. Or even if he could, it would have been with great difficulty. He certainly wouldn't be able to seek out Jesus through some eloquent request. He's not even able to deduce the importance of this Jesus who has come to his region, to his hometown. Did you see? He must be brought by his friends to Jesus. And just a quick aside here. Christian, do you see the picture of evangelism here? As Christians, we are to love people enough to bring them to Jesus that he might save them. You cannot save anybody. I cannot save anybody, but Jesus can save anybody. So this man's friends lets us as Christians be, so like this man's friends, let us be as Christians diligent through prayer, sharing the gospel, bringing people to Jesus. That's less of what's happening here, but nonetheless a good picture for us. But this man is brought, and Jesus responds to the request of the crowd by taking the man aside and healing him. Now the way Jesus does this healing, let's be honest, it's weird. And if you're a germaphobe, and maybe you've got mild germaphobia, if you're like me, you're like extreme germaphobia. This just sounds like the worst moment ever. But it's less about what is happening here and more about what is happening beyond what is doing. So it says they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay hands on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were opened, and his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Now, weirdness aside, it's not like Jesus was trying to do some magic trick, right? Like, so, okay, here we go. Now he doesn't hear everybody. Ha! Now he hears, right? Like some fingers, magic fingers. It's not like he's trying to do something like that. He's not spitting on the ground and touching a guy's tongue just to kind of show out. Certainly there are realities that he's trying to do, but think about the handicapped and the outcast of that culture. Friend, if you were the deaf man with a speech impediment, you likely wouldn't experience touch very often. And certainly not kind touch. Jesus brings this man aside, and in a way that's not really culturally odd there, heals this man. And Mark wants us to see again the tenderness with which Jesus responds to an outcast and a non-Jewish man who is in need. Jesus pulls him aside. Did you notice this? He gives him the ability to hear and corrects his broken speech, enabling him to speak clearly. Did you catch the fact that Jesus doesn't need a public spectacle here? He takes the man aside. I mean, what mercy, what grace. He could have just spoken to the man right in the moment and healed him. He didn't even have to say anything. From what Mark has told us in Jesus' power, it's not built on incantations and magic formulas. His power is built on who he is. But friends, Jesus takes the man aside and focuses on him. He's not just some sick person in a crowd. He's not just a nameless figure. He is a person. Jesus shows the value of this man by deliberately taking him aside and focusing on his need, eye to eye, face to face. This is the compassionate Jesus we meet in the Gospel of Mark. Now, not only is the healing amazing, but we get a moment of irony. Jesus tells the man, whom he has just enabled to speak, don't say anything. I mean, can you feel the tension of reading the gospel that way? It's Jesus. This is counterintuitive. He just couldn't speak. Now he can speak. He should be the first one to go out and broadcast abroad this good news. I mean, look at verses 35 through 37. And his ears were opened. His tongue was released. Think about the way that he speaks that. His tongue was released and he spoke plainly. So his tongue is released and Jesus charged them to tell no one. In a sense, chaining his tongue. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." So the people don't listen to Jesus. Surprise, surprise there. But it does beg the question of why Jesus is telling people to be quiet about what he just did. It seems to be counterintuitive. And that's not an unfair question. It's a significant question. Why would he tell these people to be silent or charge them not to share? I mean, if we were to go to other places in the Gospel of Mark, we also see him telling demons to be silent. We also see him telling Jewish people to be silent. Why? Well, one commentator gives three brief reasons that I think are pretty helpful. One, the cultural opinion of the Messiah in Jesus' day was wrapped up in military deliverance. So the idea of proclaiming this message, everyone would think, the general's here, Rome's oppression is over, he's going to lead our military, he's going to lead this uprising. So culturally, the view of Messiah was all wrong. So for people to spread this news, there would inevitably be widespread misunderstanding. The second thing, the picture of the Messiah in the Old Testament, especially Isaiah, show that the Messiah would be marked by humility, not by brash exhibitionism. So Isaiah 42, 1 through 3, listen to this. "Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice." The Messiah, the servant of the Lord, would not be one who's to be made a public spectacle of his own power. Now surely, he would be made a public spectacle, but not in terms of miraculous healings. Finally, the third reason that Jesus charges them to be silent is his work was not yet finished. Jesus' work would be finished through his death on the cross and his resurrection from the grave. You see, Jesus' mission was not yet complete. It would be that would be later in his death and resurrection, and then his people would be called to publish abroad the good news. But as we can see, the crowds don't listen, nor do they obey, which is likely why we see so many misconceptions about Jesus in his day. But all of those things did not stop the crowds from heralding that he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Inevitably, his fame spreads. Crowds gather, even in these territories hostile to Jews. People come to see and hear the message of this man. And since they are people, and people inevitably get hungry, we see another amazing miracle. So the third thing, Jesus and a hungry crowd. Now, before we dive into the specifics of the event, there's a couple things that we just need to kind of unpack for a minute. Mark is the only gospel writer to include this second feeding of thousands. And the reality is that as we read the gospel, especially as we read chapter 6, now in chapter 8, the two feedings look remarkably similar. So in both cases, the place was described as desolate. In both instances, Mark refers to Jesus' compassion for the crowd. In both accounts, Jesus asks, "How many loaves do you have?" Also, the role of prayer and the involvement of the disciples is similar. And these similarities have led some to say and to conclude that Mark was simply recording a doublet, meaning he was just recording the same miracle twice. However, there are actually significant differences between this feeding and the one previously in his gospel. First, the fact is Again, where we started, the placement of this miracle is outside Judea. He's not in the same place. This miracle takes place in Gentile territories, so the miracle serves a very different crowd, for these were not Jewish followers of Jesus, but a crowd of Gentile outsiders. And the number of the crowd is different from the feeding in chapter 6. The number in chapter 6 is 5,000 men, not including the women and children. Here, the number is 4,000 people total. The amount of leftovers was different as well. 7 baskets as opposed to 12. Also, there's the tone of the miracle. So perhaps one thing that might increase your joy or your understanding of these miracles and your delight in Christ would be to read the account in chapter 6 this afternoon and read the account in chapter 8 and see how miraculous and how glorious Jesus is in both encounters. But the amount of, in chapter 6, Jesus is responding to the needs of the people, brought to his attention by the disciples. So the disciples come to Jesus and say, hey, there's a problem. Here, Jesus initiates what he's going to do, which actually may tell us something of what the disciples thought of the crowd that had gathered. They were less concerned about non-Jewish people going hungry. But Jesus is intentional. Has compassion upon them, it says. So considering these differences, it seems clear that Mark is not simply recording the same miracle twice, but rather giving us an account of a separate event to drive home the point of the two events we've just walked through. Jesus looks upon these thousands with compassion. They followed him, and now they are in need. And Jesus, seeing their need, exercises compassion by multiplying bread for hungry people who eat it and are satisfied. Multiplying fish for hungry people who eat it and are satisfied. In those two simple statements are filled with greater meaning. So directly, Jesus provides bread. That's what happens here. This is the miracle. There's minimal food present, and Jesus takes what is present and multiplies it exponentially beyond what is needed. Why does he do this? Because he has compassion on people in need. Friends, this points us as readers to remember how God miraculously provided food for his people in the wilderness. So if you listen as Wes read to us from Deuteronomy 8, we heard the account of the Lord providing food for his people in the desert. That they never went hungry, that their clothes did not wear out, that he had preserved and protected and brought them through here. Again, in a desolate place, in the wilderness, Jesus provides bread miraculously. But the striking detail here, what makes it different from chapter 6, what makes it different from the wilderness wandering, is now the bread from God is to people who are not of the nation of Israel. That's really good news for all of us Gentiles here today. Because the bread is no longer restricted to one nationality, but to all who come to Jesus in faith. He's providing food to outsiders. People not of the nation of Israel, people cut off from communion, are receiving food at the Jewish Messiah's hand. Friends, this is a miracle. And in this miracle, there's a great revelation that in Jesus, all nations will be blessed. But the second reality, the people are satisfied. On the surface, again, this means that the crowd had full bellies. But the lasting significance of this statement in this moment is amazing. People come to Jesus, and in Jesus they are satisfied. Now these people would get hungry again. Some of you know what they feel like right now. You're hungry right now. And that happens in your life. They would need food again. But the picture Jesus gives and Mark records for us is glorious. In him, we are satisfied. All of this world, that all of the things in this world will perish, but Jesus alone can satisfy hungry souls. So what are we to make of these three events? What are we to do in taking them together? Well, let me offer a few closing thoughts. First, the reason Mark records these three and puts them together is to remind us and to instruct us that the good news of Jesus Christ, the gospel of Jesus, is for all people, for all nations. You see, friends, the events reveal that the Messiah who came first to the Jews has opened wide the door of salvation to all of him who come in faith. So think about what we read in Romans chapter 1 today. The Gospels are revealed to the Jew first and then to the Greek or to the Gentile. Perhaps an application for you today, a way to apply the sermon, is to remind yourself that apart from Christ, you are a foreigner to the kingdom of God. Yet, because of the grace of Jesus, you have been welcomed into the people of God. A second thought, Jesus saves his enemies. Thinking of the first event, we tend to think ourselves unlike the Syrophoenician woman. But friends, you and I are far more like her than we want to admit. We have sinned against God. We have done wrong things, and as Jesus has said, we are wrong people. And through our sin, we have become not just indifferent to God. We are his enemies. But in Jesus, all who come to him repenting of their sin in faith as he alone as the sacrifice are no longer his enemies, but are made his children. You see, friends, Jesus came to bear the wrath that you deserve for your sin. He came to take the punishment that you have earned through your sinful actions and through your sinful heart. He did this. He took your wrath and he took my wrath by dying on the cross in our place. He came so that we, enemies of God, may be made his children. And perhaps the last application, the closing thought, the best thing for us to do is that to remind you, Jesus alone can satisfy. We are constantly on the lookout for satisfaction. We spend money, time, energy, trying to find satisfaction. But the resounding truth at the end of this third miracle is that only in Jesus will anyone truly be satisfied. So friend, I don't know where you're at. Perhaps you're a Christian here today and you're hearing this and this reminds you and stirs your heart to the truths of the gospel in Jesus Christ. But maybe you're not a Christian. And I just point you to see that Mark would have you know that Christ alone can satisfy. That apart from Jesus, you will bear the wrath and punishment for your own sin. But in God's kindness, you don't have to. There is one who came and bore it for you. And this Jesus gives himself as your food and drink. He is the satisfaction of your hungry soul. And so as we pause in just a moment to pray, we're going to turn to observing the Lord's Supper together. And in a way, we are reminded of the truths that this passage teaches.